And there's seemingly no reaction from the U.S. government about this. The head nuclear scientist who was giving all this material, he was just pardoned. And George Bush said he was okay with just the pardoning. Imagine if that was Iraq that was doing that. Because it's Pakistan, this seems to be, they're just allowed to do whatever they like. I'm kind of running out of time, but there's a lot of other evidence as well about just some really, really strange things that the ISI did and connections between them and the 9/11 plotters. For instance, we know that, or we have very good evidence to believe that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the supposed mastermind of 9/11, that he was actually an ISI agent. Some of you may have heard of Robert Fisk. He's a very famous reporter. He's openly called Mohammed an ISI agent, as well as other experts. And we see that the Financial Times back in the early they note that back in the early 1990s that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was seen in photographs with the very elites of Pakistan. And they said that he must have, quote, felt confident with his ties to senior Pakistani Islamists whose power had been cemented within the ISI, unquote. So then we see also another guy, Syed Sheikh. He's a very interesting character, and unfortunately I don't have time to go into everything about him. But he was a person who was so important that bin Laden himself called him, quote, his favorite son and symbolically adopted him. And so he's a very important figure in Al-Qaeda, but at the same time he's a very important figure in the ISI. And he later becomes famous for killing Daniel Pearl, and he's become known as the killer of Daniel Pearl. But in fact, before that, CNN reported back just before the story of Mahmoud Ahmed broke, just the day before it broke, they reported that Syed Sheikh sent $100,000 to Mohammed Atta. And so then it was the next day that it was reported that he was actually doing that under the orders of the ISI general. And all of a sudden, the U.S. media lost interest in that story because all of a sudden it became a very scary story. But we see, so this Syed Sheikh figure, we can see from his ties, we can start to learn exactly who was involved in the 9/11 plot in the ISI. Really make a lot of connections. Another really interesting thing about Syed Sheikh is that there's a reporter from the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and this reporter claims to be an anonymous British intelligence source. And in early 2002, this reporter reported, quote, "There are many in Musharraf's government who believe that Syed Sheikh's power comes not from the ISI, but from his connections with our own CIA. The theory is that Syed Sheikh was bought and paid for," unquote. So we find that a lot of curious connections between some very important governments in the Middle East, Saudis, United Arab Emirates, Pakistan, the Taliban, and we find these strange connections with the CIA. And then we find this, which I can't go into detail of, but extensive cover-up and rewarding of Pakistan. When you'd think that Pakistan would be punished, you know, why are we going after Iraq and attacking Iraq when we have all this evidence here of Pakistani involvement? And just another example, which I don't have much time to go into, Abu Zubaydah, who's one of the Al-Qaeda leaders, there was a story a few months ago that when he was interrogated, he was interrogated by the U.S., he actually said, "I'm working for not only Al-Qaeda, but for the Saudis and the Pakistanis, and here are some phone numbers of the head of the Pakistani Air Force and three important Saudi princes," and this came out in Time magazine and some other sources. So we continually to see these connections between these different countries and the 9/11 plot. And yet, we have this very strange behavior by the Bush administration. And so I would pose one of two possibilities to consider from all this information I've given you. One is either that the U.S. was directly involved with Pakistan and these other countries in the 9/11 plot and allowed it to happen or helped make it happen, or the U.S. government was completely taken for fools, and then afterwards they covered up their foolishness and have actually, instead of punished these countries and these actors, they've actually rewarded them. And I would argue that personally I favor the first, but I would argue that in either case, this is really treasonous behavior to deceive the American people in this way, to let the true perpetrators of 9/11 go free. And in either case, it should lead to impeachment of President Bush. Thank you very much.
That was Paul Thompson of 911timeline.net speaking at the International Inquiry on 9/11 in San Francisco last March. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. Our final speaker, Robert Jensen, is a professor of journalism at the University of Texas in Austin. He is also the author of the new book, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. He spoke on May 26th in Seattle.
What I thought I would do today is talk a bit about the war in Iraq and media, but not focused especially on the media, but try and speak a bit about what we can learn about the whole society from how the media performed. And my text for today is unfortunately not out of the holy book, but out of, for journalists, the other sort of divine text, which is the New York Times. Some of you may have noticed on today's New York Times there was a very long editorial note in which the Times, in a sense, apologized for its coverage prior to the Iraq War, especially of the question of weapons of mass destruction. Many of you probably are aware, being media savvy and sort of information rich, as anti-war activists tend to be. Page A10, yes. See, somebody's been there already. I'm starting to feel like a bit of a preacher. Turn in your hymnals to A10 and sing with me. Will you raise your voices in praise of the editorial office of the New York Times? What a friend we have in the Sulzbergs. No. The New York Times was widely criticized by people in the anti-war movement for accepting uncritically many of the claims of the Bush administration and their affiliated Iraqi cohort on the existence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq prior to the war. And you all know the story. That was the linchpin of the argument for going to war. So it's not a trivial matter that the most important newspaper in the world, probably, systematically distorted the reality on the ground of those weapons, or those non-weapons, as we were to find out. And because of this criticism, the Times finally responded some months later with an examination based on their own internal review of their performance. And in one sense, I think it's important to praise them for this. 20 years ago, I can't imagine the New York Times engaging in this kind of critical self-reflection, let alone publishing the results of it. It simply wouldn't have happened. So it reflects something very important, which is both the growth in some sense and some levels of journalism's understanding of its own power as an institution. And that's a good thing. And I think it also reflects the effectiveness of activists. They would not be doing this if many of us in the room had not written those letters and sent those emails and complained loudly. Sure, go ahead and applaud yourself. I don't want to overstate the effect of this, of course. The war happened. That coverage was instrumental in building support for the war. But, of course, there is some hope we can learn from these mistakes. So this is, in some sense, a very positive development. But as I read the Times editorial note, I was, not surprisingly, disappointed in the nature of their self-critique. And from it, I think we can take a couple of lessons, not just about the problems in journalism, but the problems we face, in a sense, more broadly in the political culture in which we live. Two things I want to focus on particularly. One is, if you read this editorial note, you get a sense that they are aware they made mistakes in this case. But you get no sense that they're aware of the bigger structural problem in reporting. So they point out that they uncritically accepted evidence and reports from Iraqi defectors and administration officials, and that they realized that was now a mistake. They were duped. But there's no sense in this editorial note that it's not a one-time problem, that in fact the single most probably important problem in the professional practices of contemporary corporate journalism is this slavish devotion to official sources. That is, in fact, the fundamental problem of the professional practices of contemporary journalism under the rubric of what they call objectivity. In fact, there's no recognition that in that pursuit of so-called objectivity by subordinating themselves to those kinds of official sources, which mostly come out of the government and the corporate sector, that in fact they routinely misdirect the attention of the public, distort issues, and provide distinctly non-objective news under the guise of objectivity. So it's a reminder that when people own up to mistakes, there can be different levels of analysis, in a sense. We're seeing this all over the place. The story of torture by American guards at the prison in Baghdad, Abu Ghraib, or as our president pronounces it, well, I can't follow how many different ways our president pronounces that name if you saw the speech, so I won't try. No. Later, when things devolve, I'll go into just straight-out Bush jokes, right? When I feel like I'm losing you, then I'll pull out all the Texas stuff I have. But the same argument that there are problems that have been addressed because these were individual failures. But of course, they're not individual failures. The fact is that Judith Miller, the lead reporter on weapons of mass destruction at the New York Times, the hissing. Remember, you're in the house of the Lord here. Let's keep it civil. That there are some very specific problems with the way Judith Miller goes forward and does her job. I've read accounts of speeches of Judith Miller, and I think there are some specific problems with Ms. Miller. But it's not a problem that you can locate in one individual or even in a handful of individuals. It's not just that Judith Miller and her immediate editors failed. It's that the entire system fails. To use the metaphor we heard out of the Bush administration, the problem they want to tell us is a few bad apples. But in the case of contemporary journalism and much of this political culture, it's not the apples that are bad. It's the entire barrel, of course, that is rotted and rotted right to the core. So one thing I take away from this New York Times apology is how easy it is to pin the blame for things on people and failures in the moment instead of seeing structure, which we always have to remember, I think. The second thing that I thought was important about this and what really infuriated me about it is that within the context of correcting so-called their errors, the New York Times repeats the fundamental error of American journalism during the run-up to the war, and that is, I would argue, that they accepted the Bush administration framework for understanding why the war happened. Now, the shifting rationale, of course, we're all familiar with. It was originally mostly about weapons of mass destruction, with some talk of ties between the regime of Saddam Hussein and terrorist groups. And then, as those proved to be fraudulent rationales, we shifted to the liberation of the Iraqi people, replacing a dictator, putting a democracy in the heart of the Middle East, which will spark reform in the whole region. So we all know that these rationale have shifted, but the question is, were those ever the rationale in the first place? Those were reasons stated for a war, but were they the actual reasons? And here is where I think the failure of American journalism was most profound, is that they accepted, they might have pecked away at the edges of that, and especially after the war, or after the end of major combat operations, the failure to find weapons of mass destruction did produce eventually some critical reporting by American journalists. And in fact, we should acknowledge some of it's been very good reporting. Journalism isn't a monolith. There are better and worse reporters and editors. And there has been some good coverage in the mainstream press. But the problem is it's always, all of it, even the best of it, has accepted that those three stated rationale were in fact the reasons for going to war. And you could critique Bush within that framework for what were called intelligence failures. In other words, you can say, listen, Bush just got confused. Well, Bush is always confused, so let's see. Bush's advisors just got confused. They were duped by Ahmed Chalabi, who was actually, now we're told, maybe even working for the Iranians. And so there's stories that float about how this happened, but they always take as a given that the stated reasons the Bush administration gave for going to war were in fact real reasons and not simply pretexts. Now, if most of the American public has never heard an alternative to those stated reasons, they've never been given a systematic, credible argument about why the United States might go to war in Iraq for other reasons, then it's not surprising that's the universe in which people then circulate. And that's the only understanding they could possibly have. And therefore, the only conclusion they could possibly reach is that the Bush administration was perhaps incompetent. That's the worst you can imagine. The Bush administration just didn't do their job. But of course, there is an alternative explanation for why the U.S. went to war. And it's worth reminding ourselves what it is, and I think, more importantly, how to speak about it in public when much of the public, because of these failures of journalism, have never heard it articulated. So, on one level, it's an easy question. Why did the United States go to war in Iraq? Well, the question could be asked earlier, why does the U.S. care about the Middle East? I mean, is it that the U.S. is trying to corner the date and fig market? Is it that the military just loves to do desert training? Let's quiz you all here. Why does the United States concentrate a significant component of its military force and much of its diplomatic energy on the Middle East? Oil, what a shock. Okay, so oil. Okay, we'll get to that. Hold on. All right, so everybody knows that the only reason the U.S. cares about the Middle East is oil. Now, that would seem to at least be the beginning of a discussion about why the United States might go to war in Iraq, but the U.S. media sort of systematically avoided that question. And when it did come up, it came up in the most sort of ridiculous fashion that it was easy to dismiss. So a journalist at a press conference might say, what do you say to the argument this is all about oil? And Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and these, and they would scoff. They'd say, of course we're not going in there to take over the oil fields of Iraq. How silly that the United States wouldn't do that. End of story. And of course it's true. The United States has no intention of going in and taking control of the oil fields of Iraq through a colonial process that we might recognize from an earlier period. It's simply impossible to imagine that, even if they wanted to do it. Okay. And then sometimes people would push a bit more and say, well, this is a war about, you know, access to oil, because the United States, which was once a major oil producer itself, is increasingly dependent on imported oil. And so this is all about ensuring access so that we don't have any repeat of the oil embargo of the 1970s. And the administration would scoff at that, because that's largely a fraudulent claim, too. It doesn't make any sense, because there's a world market for oil. The United States actually is less dependent on Middle Eastern oil than Western Europe and Japan. We get much of our oil from, we do get a lot of oil from Saudi Arabia, but Canada is a big oil supplier, Nigeria, Venezuela. The United States has multiple sources of oil, and it's not the case that the United States is afraid necessarily of being cut off by the Arabs, because the Arabs are going to sell their oil. You know, oil, you can't eat oil. It's only worth something if you can sell it, and you're going to sell it on a world market, and access to oil is no longer the question in this world's economy. So if you offer those sort of straw figure reasons, they are easily knocked down, leading people to say, oh, well, it's really not about oil then. But of course, it's all about oil. And there is no other reason for the United States to care about the Middle East. And the question is, how do you talk about that and explain that? And I think the way to do that is that a simple analysis that has been available and circulating on the sort of left progressive side of the fence for a long time, which is that it's not about owning the oil, and it's not about having access to the oil. It's about controlling the flow of oil and the flow of oil profits. That in an industrial world that runs on oil, without oil, this world that we know would not function. The state, the nation that has its hand on the lever of the oil fields of the Middle East, has enormous power. There is oil all over the world, but still the largest and most readily accessible reserves of oil are in the Middle East. Everybody knows. Saudi Arabia has the largest known reserves. Iraq is second. And in other words, it is not about owning or having access to, it's about controlling that oil. And of course, we don't control the oil by literally, you know, running those countries. The United States has created in the Middle East a variety of relationships with different governments to ensure that kind of control. For all of the talk about our troubles with the Saudis, the Saudi government is basically a creation of the United States right after World War II. It wouldn't exist without United States support. And of course, after 1990, the United States had what was at one point thought to be perhaps a permanent military presence, but no more. So it's about how you build a regional system in which you can call the shots. The Saudis were part of it. The Iran under the Shah was part of it until we lost Iran in 79. Even non-oil producing states have a role in it. Egypt, for instance, is a favorite client of the United States, not because it's a big oil producer, but because of its willingness in the late 1970s to cut a deal independent of the other Arab states with Israel and sign a peace treaty for which Sadat was rewarded with what is now about $2 billion a year in aid. Turkey has a role in it on the periphery to be a base for United States power. Jordan has found its role in subordinating itself to the U.S. system. So the whole region is, in a sense, run by the U.S. And the big prize that the U.S. has had its eye on for some time now is Iraq. Not because Saddam Hussein was a butcher and a tyrant, which he has been consistently, but because those oil reserves, if they could be brought under U.S. control, would solidify American power and also give us much more leverage to deal with the Saudis. If we, in fact, are controlling Iraqi oil through a nice, compliant puppet government, then that gives the United States government a much freer hand to deal with problems they have with the Saudis. And of course, if you can establish 14 permanent military bases in Iraq, it's all to the better, because then you have a base from which to project American power in perpetuity, perhaps, or as long as this whole system continues. Well, if you talk through that question at that level, then it starts to make sense why the United States government would, in fact, engage in the Iraq War. Now, it might not have been rational in the sense that their planning wasn't very good. They were arrogant. They took on more than they thought, more than they should have taken on. You can make all sorts of critiques, but at that point, the policy at least begins to look rational. You can see why planners would, in fact, want to go to war in Iraq. Well, if the United States news media had systematically articulated that kind of argument, the American people would have had a choice of ways to understand what was happening. But in fact, the mainstream corporate commercial news media virtually ignored that almost 100%. I have yet to see in a commercial newspaper or on commercial television any in-depth exploration of this kind of analysis. Now, many of you were nodding as we were going along. It's not news to many of you who probably read outside of the mainstream corporate news media. But you have to remember, most of this country does not read outside or listen outside of the corporate news media. And it's that kind of inability to see the role that the news media had, even as they're correcting their own mistakes, that I think leaves this New York Times editorial note and correction, I think in some sense doing as much damage as it does good. Because in explaining their own failures, they are reinforcing a point of view that sets further in the public mind, I think, basically a misunderstanding of why U.S. policy happens the way it happens. And of course, from there you could go on, and if the media were doing their job as a critical and independent voice in the culture, they would do their job, to go on to explain there's nothing particularly special about the Middle East. That is, the pattern of U.S. control in the Middle East is not significantly different in character from the pattern of U.S. control of the entire world, most notably in the post-World War II period. In other words, once you start down that path, you start down the path of understanding the United States as an empire. And it starts to make sense. U.S. policy that may seem otherwise chaotic and sometimes crazy makes perfect sense. And then you can start to see that the problem isn't just George Bush, which is an important thing for people to understand. I always say George Bush is a problem, but George Bush is not the problem. George Bush is simply reigning over a particularly ideologically fanatical group of reactionaries who are implementing consistent U.S. policy of empire building in a way that I think does take us down a particularly dangerous road, but is wholly explainable and understandable. And understandable not by simply demonizing George Bush and Paul Wolfowitz, although I must admit, in those cases, it is extremely attractive to do that. In other words, you can talk all you want about how dumb George Bush is and how sleazy Paul Wolfowitz is, and maybe even how evil Dick Cheney is, if you want to go into more theological spaces. But that's not the nature of the problem. The nature of the problem is consistent throughout Republican and Democratic administrations. It's the project of American empire building that after World War II went into full speed, and which, if we are going to be politically effective, we're going to have to come to terms with. I wrote a piece over the weekend that was on the web this on Monday, in which I tried to say that. Nancy Pelosi, who's the leading Democrat in the House, and a very liberal Democrat from San Francisco, the heart of liberalism in America, was kicked around a bit last week for saying in public that she thought George Bush was incompetent. That was the word she used. And that she challenged his leadership and his judgment. And she used the phrase, it's time to recognize the emperor has no clothes. And the piece I wrote, and I think what's so important for those of us who work in the peace movement or whatever progressive kinds of movements we're part of, is to understand that the central problem isn't that the emperor has no clothes. The problem is that the empire has no clothes. That is, the goals and the motivations and the methods of the empire are what are the problem. And they have now been laid bare before the world. We really didn't need this example to know. We should, by this time, understand what the empire is, how it operates, and what it is willing to do to achieve its goals. We have, after all, a legacy here in the post-World War II period of all of Latin America, for instance, most prominently Central America. We have the really grotesque crimes of Indochina. We have U.S. intervention in Southern Africa, and of course the whole of the history of U.S. intervention in the Middle East. And in other words, anywhere you go on the globe and look at foreign policy of the United States post-World War II, you see the same pattern. And it is a pattern of empire building. It is a pattern of making sure that U.S. control over the terms of the world economy are not set anywhere other than in Washington. And that all challenges to that, any attempt at independent development by any nation, will be crushed and crushed brutally. That is the story of Central America. It's the story of Southeast Asia. It's the story of Southern Africa. Sometimes the U.S. does it through direct intervention, as we have just seen in Iraq.
In the name of democracy.
Yeah. Sometimes it does it through proxy wars, creating terrorist forces, as it did most notably in Nicaragua. Sometimes it does it by simply propping up the most repressive forces available to do the job. But it's important to remember that empire building has gone on through Republican and Democratic administrations alike. And we have to finally give up, I think, some of the understandably attractive, but in the end, politically very debilitating mythologies. The most notable one, when I speak of this, that often, I think, bothers people, is to tell the truth about people like John F. Kennedy, the real liberal darlings of post-World War II American history, who are every bit as much at the center of this as the kind of easy-to-hate reactionaries like Richard Nixon. The effect of both presidents in the world outside the borders of the United States is virtually indistinguishable. that in fact it was John F. Kennedy who began the routine bombing of civilians in South Vietnam, not bombing North Vietnam, bombing the civilian population of South Vietnam for its unwillingness to accept a U.S. puppet regime. And of course, the record of the United States under Kennedy in Latin America is particularly brutal. Many of the so-called counter-revolutionary methods, counter-insurgency warfare was begun under the Kennedy administration in ways that you certainly can't ignore in Cuba, but were taking place throughout the hemisphere. And you can move on through every post-war republic or post-war president, Republican or Democrat, and see the same pattern, usually with the cooperation of Congress. And that includes even the human rights president, Jimmy Carter, whose own crimes are equally obvious. Crimes of support for the Shah, support for the most repressive forces in places like El Salvador, support for one of the really grotesque genocides of the post-World War II era committed by the Indonesians in East Timor. Many of you know the story, but it is unbroken, Republican and Democrat alike. Now, where I'm going to end, because I do want to actually stick to my pledge to speak briefly so we can discuss, is what do we learn from, what lesson do we take for political organizing and activism from this? Well, where I find myself coming down these days is understanding the sort of enormity of this system. In other words, trying to have no illusions about how this country actually operates when it goes outside its own borders. The question of U.S. policy internally is perhaps a more complex story. But certainly outside the borders of the U.S., it's very simple and very easy to understand and also very difficult to come to terms with, given our own sense of the country, our own mythology, which even personally, I think many of us find difficult to disentangle from. If you hear the story of the noble founding fathers bringing peace, freedom, and justice to the world finally, and you hear that for year after year, it does sort of get into you in funny ways. And I often find myself not wanting to believe the things I know to be true about the conduct of this country overseas in my own lifetime. So it's important to have no illusions, because that, I think, helps us have realistic expectations. And that's what I think is the most important thing for people involved in, call it what you like, anti-war, anti-empire, left, progressive, radical, dissident, organizing, whatever it is you consider yourself. What's really important these days is to have realistic expectations. If this is in fact the nature of the system, defeating George Bush in 2004 is not going to radically change the system. It may be a goal that we should strive for because the possibilities of a second Bush administration untethered from concerns about being reelected could produce a country that would make any progressive organizing much more difficult. And we might want to work to defeat George Bush, but we should do it with no illusions that not only John Kerry, but anybody the Democrats would have put up in the contemporary context would shift this country, in part because one person doesn't shift a country, even the president. So it's important to have some realistic expectation of what can be accomplished in the short term so that one understands it is, in fact, a long-term struggle. And I think the example, and this is what I'll leave with, where I can make this the most clear, is February 15th, 2003. I'm sure there was a demonstration in Seattle on February 15th, yes?
Yes.
And I suspect you probably had the biggest crowd for a political event you've had in recent memory. Yes? How many did you have?
Except for WTO.
Well, the WTO, you don't get to claim that for just your own. There were some people from outside Seattle who came, you know. How many did you have here in Seattle on February 15th? 20,000? 20? That's too bad. We had 10,000 in Austin, and I was prepared to do my Texas. We had more than you, but you beat us. You're a bigger city, though, so. Proportionally, we actually had a bigger demonstration than you had. I don't know if that's true or not. But it was an incredibly inspiring day. In Austin, we did our demonstration, our rally, on the steps of the state capitol. And it always feels nice to have a bunch of radicals cheering on the steps of the state capitol where a legislature that sort of defines reactionary is usually doing business. And I emceed that event, and I looked out over the crowd, and I was flabbergasted. I expected at most 5,000 people. We had a sound system that, at best, reached back to about the first 4,000 or 5,000 people. The people in the back didn't hear a word we said on the stage, but it didn't matter, because people were there not necessarily to listen to speeches, but to send a message. And I stood up on that podium and was just amazed and felt good. I felt good at what we had accomplished. I had, as a lot of people locally had, and I'm sure many of you did, put a lot of energy into organizing that particular day's events. And of course, we knew we were part of a bigger event, the largest single coordinated political event worldwide in the history of the planet. 10 to 15 million people, depending on whose estimates you believe. And it was impossible not to be really buoyed by that. It was an incredible day. And at the same time, every minute I was up on that platform, I was well aware that the war was going to happen no matter what we did that day. It simply didn't matter what we did. It was quite clear by February 15th that this war was going to happen. The process had been set in motion long before that. And there was nothing short of perhaps armed revolution in the streets of the United States that was going to stop that. And the point I want to make is that it didn't leave me depressed. It didn't leave me depressed that I had spent weeks, along with many others in Austin, along with many others all over the country and all over the world, organizing an event that was going to have no effect on policy. Because it was worth doing for several reasons. It was worth doing simply because to stay silent in that run-up to war, I think for many of us, would have just been impossible to live with. But more importantly, it gave us a chance to reach out to new people who were so horrified by what the Bush administration was doing, people who might not otherwise have ever thought about foreign policy, but were suddenly sort of, it was almost a visceral response. People were scared. They could tell that these people in the White House were unleashing something that was very dangerous. So it was an opportunity to build the movement, to bring in people who otherwise had not been part of that movement. And I knew that what happened on February 15th wasn't really what mattered. It's what we did with that energy after February 15th. And it turned out we learned some painful lessons in Austin. We weren't ready for that many people. We had structures in place that could accommodate demonstrations of a couple of 100. We knew how to do, I mean, I can tell you, if you want somebody to do a demonstration in front of the state capitol in Austin that will attract 50 people, I'm your man. I know how to do that. I've been doing that for 8 years. Man, we got it down, you know? We did it through the Iraq sanctions work, same 50 people every time. Sometimes we'd swell to 200 when there would be a bombing. Kosovo, we were out there in Kosovo, same 50 people, you know? East Timor, some of the stuff around that, same 50 people. And it wasn't until 9/11 that the ranks swelled. And we found out we didn't know what to do. We didn't have infrastructure for people. We didn't have work for people to do. We found out a lot about our own limitations from that. We learned a bit. Then we came up on the Iraq War, and what we had learned was outstripped by the response there. So it was very much a learning process, and it was useful for that. Now, that's the kind of, I think, calculation we have to be willing to make. In other words, putting energy with, not only energy, but putting real passion into activities like that, knowing full well they will, in the short term, fail. And it seems to me that most important for people on the left side of the fence right now is an understanding of just what that means. That, in fact, we aren't going to win in 2004. And we are not going to win in 2005. I don't know when we're going to win. I do have a sense that we are going to win, that the forces of some better view of what the world can be will prevail. And that's as much an article of faith as anything else. I believe it because I'm not sure how I would get through the day if I didn't believe that. But I don't think it's necessarily going to happen even in my own lifetime. I'm 45. I don't know how much longer I've got to kick around on this planet. But that's where when one struggles with those things, you have to look to history. Because history is the story of the incredible capacity for brutality and cruelty of the human species. And it is also equally the story of solidarity and compassion and the possibilities for the human species to overcome their own brutality and cruelty. And of course, you're all familiar with any number of examples where history teaches us that, in fact, those brutalities and cruelties can be overcome. But they're overcome almost always, and not almost, they are overcome always by people who commit to projects that they have no guarantee will succeed in their own lifetime, let alone in the short term. So when the first white abolitionist society was formed in the United States in 1815, it was half a dozen or so Quaker men in Tennessee who sat down to form the Tennessee Manumission Society. I can't believe that they thought they were going to end the practice of slavery within the next year. I can't believe that they were so naive to believe it was going to end even in their own lifetimes. And in fact, most of those men at that meeting did in fact go to their graves before slavery was overturned. So it's that kind of history that reminds us, I think, that the work we do, even when it seems to fail in the short term, is worth doing. It's worth doing not only because it's the right thing to do, it's worth doing also because, as the subtitle of this book I just wrote suggests, in Citizens of the Empire, the Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, it's worth doing because it is, if you live in the empire, if you come to terms with what it means to be a citizen of the empire, the only way you can claim your own humanity, I think, is to struggle and to resist the very policies that that empire is pursuing around the world. Thank you. So if people could speak up so everybody can hear, and then I'll repeat the question for the videotaping for cable access. I think you were first. Go ahead. What Kerry would do, I don't know. But I don't think that a serious U.S. military attack on Iran is even thinkable at this point. They've lost Iraq, which they haven't come to terms with yet, but they've lost in Iraq. Whatever you think about the morality of the war and the reasons for it, if you just look at it purely empirically, the U.S. cannot maintain this, and it will not be able to. And they have to digest this. If they had won in Iraq, it would have even taken time to digest the success. But certainly it's going to take them a long time to digest the failure. The military is depleted. There's no public support for it. I think the notion that they're going to march on Tehran is just unthinkable. For one thing, Iran is not Iraq. It's not. The political situation internal to Iran is very complex, but if American soldiers set foot in Iranian soil, even people who hate the mullahs would not sit still. They would, I think, rise up against the U.S., no matter what you read in New York Times op-ed columns about how much all the Iranians are waiting for us to come and fix their problems. So that I'm not worried about, simply because they're going down in flames in Iraq. The long-term project is different. I mean, that's a question which is impossible to predict because no one knows the conditions that will be on the ground in 2 years or 5 years or whatever. So at the moment, this sort of juggernaut is stopped. And, at one point, especially after Afghanistan, when we had the axis of evil identified, there was a lot of talk about who's next. Is it going to be Syria? Is it going to be Iran? The only potential candidate is really Syria for one simple reason. It's the only country weak enough in the Middle East for the U.S. to actually attack. Because the United States is not going to attack anybody that could actually put up a serious fight. And the only country that's a potential target at this point is Syria. And they can't even do Syria at this point. So that, I think, is a long-term question. And there's really no way to know much about it at this point. The other thing I just want to comment briefly on, this question of why do they hate us and sort of did we, in a sense, bring on 9/11 ourselves. It's another one of those things that I think is important, how we talk in public about it. First of all, It's true that the attacks of 9/11 are directly related to U.S. foreign policy. After all, they didn't attack Canada. They didn't attack Belgium. I mean, why not? Why did they attack us? It's not hard to figure out. If you look at the recruitment tapes that Osama bin Laden circulated before 9/11, they talked about three issues: U.S. support for Israel in the Israel-Palestine conflict, the economic embargo that was at that point on Iraq that was devastating Iraqi society, and the presence of U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia. Well, those are three positions of the United States that not only Osama bin Laden objects to, but I objected to. In fact, many of you in the room no doubt objected to. And that didn't create Osama bin Laden, in a sense. The kind of twisted theology of people like that, I don't claim to understand. But what it clearly did was those U.S. policies made it possible for Osama bin Laden and people like him to circulate rather freely in the Middle East and the Muslim world more generally, and to attract support, even if it was simply passive support and you know, the kind of support when people didn't resist. So it's important to talk about foreign policy and how it created the conditions that made 9/11 happen, I think, in a way that doesn't lead people to say, oh, you just are blaming the U.S. for 9/11, or justifying it somehow, which, of course, I don't think it can be justified. The other point about why do they hate us, I think it's important to not just say, well, they hate us because of our foreign policy, but to say, listen, it's the wrong question. Because, first of all, who is they? They don't hate us. All three of those terms are wrong: they, hate, and us. First of all, they is not a monolith. The Arab and the Muslim world is diverse in all sorts of ways. And they don't hate. They object to policies. Yes, there are people in that world that probably have some sort of irrational hatred. But most of the resentment against the U.S. is not hatred. Hatred implies a kind of irrational, emotional reaction. These are people who object to U.S. policies and have objected quite clearly for a long time. And the other thing is, who is us? It's not us they hate. It's not some, you know, generic concept of American or the West. They hate the policy. So the question isn't why do they hate us, it's why do different sections of those societies object to U.S. policies for what are often perfectly reasonable reasons, and reasons many of us would share. I'll just go with the hands I saw first here, and then we'll go in the back. Yeah, yeah, that's an interesting question. Why? What happened in Haiti, and why did it happen? It is true that Haiti is a relatively small and not particularly resource-rich country. It's a curious kind of almost footnote to American policy. Well, one answer is that part of U.S. policy is consistently to smash independence. Right? It doesn't even matter where or why. You have to derail the possibility that people can actually chart their own destiny. You don't want people to have that idea. I mean, think about Cuba, which is the most obvious example of this. The U.S. assault on Cuba isn't a result of Castro allying himself with the Soviet Union. The U.S. assault on Cuba began when the revolution was successful. The United States simply was, once it was clear what Castro and the Cuban Revolution was aiming for, it had to be destroyed no matter whether it got Soviet aid or not, because it was a problem to have that close to the United States in our backyard, an example of a nation that took its own affairs into its own hands and kicked out the American-backed puppets. You couldn't allow that to happen. It didn't matter what the economic questions were in Cuba. That simply couldn't be allowed, just like it couldn't be allowed in Vietnam or anywhere. So there's always that sort of lesson that the world has to be taught, that independent development is simply not acceptable. So the U.S. had candidates and people they wanted in place. When Aristide was first elected, it was a shock to the U.S. because they just assumed their own candidate, who basically backed a kind of IMF World Bank economic scheme, would be elected. And the U.S. had no idea that all this organizing was going on in the, you know, basically in the slums and among the people. So they were willing to put Aristide back in power after the initial coup that kicked him out, and this was all under Clinton, put him back in power because they thought he'd been disciplined enough, that he had accepted the conditions of United States dominance. Turned out he was still, you know, a little recalcitrant on that front. So when the United States simply got tired of that it decided to back the usual array of kind of terrorist thugs to kick him out. Now, internal in Haiti, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of complexity. Aristide didn't turn out to be a sort of representative of the people, perhaps, that many hoped he would be. There's lots of accusations of corruption and all sorts of things. And it's not really our place to, you know, weigh in on that from my point of view. It's a place for the Haitians to figure out what they want, but they have to be able to figure out what they want independent of U.S. domination, which is now impossible because the U.S. engineered that. And it's also, you know, Haiti's a good place for companies to go, with lots of cheap labor. There's all sorts of, you know, minor economic benefits for American corporations in Haiti, just as there is money to be made anywhere you go in the world almost. Yeah. Over here. Yeah. Yeah, the question is, I think you're right. The first step in this is coming to terms with the actual history of the country, which is not just about the post-World War II project of empire. It's literally the entire history of the country, which we are sort of systematically mistaught from the foundational act of this country, which was the only genocide, large-scale genocide in recorded human history that I know of that was almost completely successful. That is, the European invaders killed literally almost every Indian here to establish this country. I mean, you start with that and move forward, and that's, I think, the first step. What's after that? Well, I'm not really much on trying to articulate kind of utopias, and I know you weren't really asking for a utopia, but it seems to me that how one thinks about political work is to formulate a set of principles, principles about equality and justice and, you know, a real equitable distribution of resources that takes seriously the notion that all human life is of equal value. You start with articulating all of those principles and then move into, you know, further detail about rejecting capitalism, for instance, in my case, or rejecting, I think eventually we have to talk about, you know, sort of overcoming the nation state. But you articulate principles and then you look at what is possible in the moment and move toward those reforms, in a sense. Not because you think the reforms will make the system perfect, but because unless one believes in full-scale revolution at this point, and if you do, I would suggest you get professional help. Because if anybody thinks that, you know, this is 1917 in Russia and picking up a gun is going to fundamentally, you know, revolutionize the system, you're living in a dream world. So you work for reforms, I would argue, but with a very revolutionary and radical underpinning. And then when you achieve those successes, you're in a different place, and you can see what is possible from that place. So I'm anti-capitalist. I think capitalism is inconsistent with democracy and with any humane conception of human social life. Okay, now I'm under no illusions that capitalism is going to disintegrate, you know, in the next couple of weeks. So, for instance, I've done work on sort of labor organizing. Not because I think if you just got labor unions stronger in capitalism, everything would be better, but because that's a step toward trying to educate people, organize people in the workplace. And then if you could build the labor movement in the U.S. to the point where it actually had real political strength, then you could look around and say, okay, we've made that accomplishment. We've gone that far. What's the next step? But you can't anticipate that next step unless you're clairvoyant. You can't know what the conditions on the ground are going to be. So, you know, I could spin some story about what I'd like society to look like, but it would bear no relation to any, you know, real world that I can think of, because I don't know enough to do that. All I can do is articulate principles, see what I think are the compelling political tasks at the moment, and move toward them. Now, the question that's inherent, I think, in your point is, if people have been conditioned their whole lives to believe that the world in which they live is the only world possible, you know, it's the acronym TINA, there is no alternative, which Margaret Thatcher gave us. So if you wanted to talk about something other than capitalism, the response was there is no alternative. And for people who have been propagandized their whole lives to believe that, you do have to say something that makes them believe there is something else possible. And that's what I think leads people to want to construct, you know, systems and utopias. that will, they think will be compelling to people, but I just don't see that as a viable project. And I don't try to do it. You know, the question is, do people want to take control of their own lives or not? And if so, how do you make incremental steps toward the ability to do that? You were the last one then. Yeah. Okay, so the question is, why is there not more energy for impeachment, given that George Bush willfully lied to the American public to justify crimes against peace, the highest level of crimes under international law? Yeah, on the surface, that sounds impeachable. But there's a problem, and the problem is there's no political movement strong enough to put forward the proposition. So you can talk about it in the abstract, and in fact, there may be a way in which you could use it to get discussions going. But in a world in which the Democrats in Congress are as meek as they are, who would carry that project forward? If public support could make that happen, we would have a movement strong enough that impeachment would be kind of trivial. If we had a movement that could actually bring impeachment to bear, we'd be running the world at this point. And if you could impeach him on the right offenses, unlike, for instance, the impeachment of Nixon, which went forward on totally trivial grounds and ignored his particular crimes. But the point is, the movement has no political strength to do that. We're not even anywhere near it. So to talk about it in the abstract as a sort of principle is fine. And maybe even to get a petition going, impeach Bush, because you want to, while you're tabling somewhere, you want to engage people and you think that might grab them. That's fine too. In other words, it's a tactic that might have some value, but as a realistic political project, who would do it? I mean, if we had a movement that could convince Nancy Pelosi to bring articles of impeachment against Bush, we would be a very different movement than we are right now. So the reason I think most people wouldn't take it up is a realistic assessment of what it would take to make it successful, and we're nowhere near that. So we're, you know, three or four steps before that. But it's an interesting question because it raises a different issue in a sense, which is how do you get traction in a world where people can say, you can say to people, listen, Bush lied. You know he lied, and I know he lied. And he lied because he just wanted to go to war for the power and privilege of a small elite. And people will say, yeah, whatever. You know, I mean, we're still at that phase where we have to connect to people who, even to people who know some of the truth. And it's a long movement-building project before we get to the point, I think, where we could send George Bush home to Texas. But I would say on behalf of the, and I'll end with this, on behalf of the state of Texas, if you guys can figure a way to get him out, we'll take him back. We'll give him sort of refugee status in Texas, and we'll take him back. And what we do with him after we get him back, that's our business. Again, thanks for coming out. Thanks to Richard.
That was Professor Robert Jensen of the University of Texas, also the author of the new book, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, speaking on May 26 in Seattle. Thanks to Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio for that tape, and to Mariah Gallardin of TUC Radio for the 9/11 material heard in our first hour. Tapes of the 9/11 conference we've been playing are available at tucradio.org. And you can contact us at the program at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. We'll always be filled by